This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and on this 11th anniversary of September 11th, 2001, we consider where the world is today, where liberties, life, and war have evolved to since those events. We'll be speaking live with David Swanson, the author of War is a Lie, and looking at the events of that day with an acoustic review of the events of 11 September 2001. Stay tuned. This is 5 o'clock shadow. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And today, as we go through the sunspot cycle, the 11th year past the events of September 11th, 2001, we find ourselves at a time of more global war. And despite the denial of President Obama of the viability of Al-Qaeda, the organization and its affiliates have actually emboldened themselves with the overthrow in Libya that was assisted by United States intelligence and NATO bombing, with the U.S., Turkish, and NATO assistance for the Islamists that are now attempting to overthrow the nation of Syria. There have been hundreds of thousands of lives lost since September 11th, 2001, in addition to the approximately 3,000 in New York City. And to help us get a perspective on these developments and events and the erosion of the freedom to travel and the diminishing of civil liberties, we are now joined live by David Swanson, the author of War is a Lie. He is also with RootsAction.org. Welcome back to 5 o'clock shadow, David.
Great to be here.
Where are we today?
Well, we're not where we should be. We should have looked at the horror of September 11th and thought about what brought it about and changed those policies, not just the immediate lack of attention to preventing that attack, but the forces that that made that attack more likely, the occupation and devastation and bombing of other people's countries that was antagonizing them to that extent. This was not out of the blue. This was not because someone hated our freedoms. This was a response to kicking in doors and occupying towns and bombing houses, and it was not a forgivable response. It was not an acceptable or moral or legal response. But you need to look at what the causes are. Instead, we doubled down. We aggravated the very policies. We created a war on terrorism that, predictably enough, increased terrorism around the world. And we continued down the very path that had caused September 11th with a plan that was developed and expanded very rapidly immediately after September 11th into a laundry list of wars and occupations and overthrows to be accomplished in the coming years. Exactly not the relationship with the world that we needed to move to.
In a moment, we'll speak about the war and death and destruction that has been unleashed by the United States in the wake of September 11th, 2001. But I'd like you to just elaborate a little bit, David, about what were the causes of resentment that would create such a militant operation and seething resentment over the years? Are you speaking of, for instance, the United States' support for the regime in Saudi Arabia, the Palestine-Israeli question, Bahrain, the military bases? What are some of the antecedents that you think could lead people to execute an operation like 9/11?
Well, if we think Osama bin Laden had something to do with it, and if we think that his statements reflect his motivations, then certainly Saudi Arabia and Israel-Palestine are at the top of the list. But if we just look at the the sentiments of people in the Muslim world, in the Arab world, in what we call the Middle East. These are the kinds of grievances that are creating still this level of hostility. The United States claims humanitarian purposes, claims humanitarian outrage when it wants to seize an opportunity to overthrow one of the dictators on its list. So we're outraged about Syria or Libya and so forth. But when it comes to Saudi Arabia, where we're supporting a brutal dictatorship, or Bahrain, or any number of other countries, you don't have that outrage. You have silence. And yet there is outrage among the people of Saudi Arabia, even though the U.S. has taken troops out of there eventually, quietly, in response to 9/11. And there is outrage all over the world at the support of the United States for the brutal crimes of Israel.
There have been, since September 11th, 2001, a greater number of American troops killed in the various wars in Iraq, the operations in Afghanistan, the quiet wars in Pakistan, Somalia, and elsewhere around the world. Can you give us a perspective? I mean, one, I believe, takes the position that every human life is sacred, whether it be in New York, Manhattan, or Pakistan. So can you take us around the world in terms of the excess deaths that have been created as a reaction to 9/11?
Well, I agree with you that every unnecessary death is a horrible tragedy to be avoided, if at all possible. And September 11th was a horrible, horrible crime, but not nearly the largest. I mean, in the United States alone, we lose more people to unnecessary causes every year than we lost to terrorism on September 11th. We lose far more people to unnecessarily unsafe working conditions, to small-time gun violence, to suicide, any number of causes, including lack of health coverage, that could easily be avoided, but don't involve the evil of some human or some group of humans intentionally trying to murder you violently. And this is what grabs people's attention, with a great assist from a lot of propaganda coming out of the government. And so we're obsessed with the danger of terrorism, which is far down the list of dangers. And when you go around the world and you see the level of death from economic policies, many of them imposed by our country, the death from starvation and lack of medicine, and you see the death from warfare, including wars instigated with 9/11 as the excuse, as the moral, if not the legal, excuse for the wars. The level of death on 9/11 itself just pales in comparison. We're looking at well over a million dead people in Iraq, on top of the incredibly high death rate under the sanctions that preceded 2003. We're looking at millions of refugees in and outside of Iraq, also in Pakistan, from our drone wars that we think of as so humane. We're looking at tens of thousands of new deaths in Afghanistan, where some have calculated 2 million dead from war violence over the past few decades of wars instigated in large part by our country. And these are things that don't go away. 9/11 happened, and there is still suffering among family members and those injured and those who were unnecessarily poisoned in trying to assist in the cleanup. But in Fallujah, women don't give birth without the horror of facing terrible birth defects. You know, we've just now started cleaning up the Agent Orange in Vietnam in a serious way. The disaster from our wars, from the cluster bombs, from the depleted uranium, from the environmental destruction, goes on and on and on for decades and centuries to come.
The horror of an airborne object destroying an edifice is one that is certainly tragic and traumatic to many Americans, but it is certainly not a unique event in the operation of drones, which has been exponentially increased under the administration of President Barack Obama. Can you speak to the new automated warfare that seems to be conducted with far more callousness because of the superiority that is claimed for American lives with troops outside of the zone of target and danger?
Yeah, it's remarkable the arguments that are made, including by the president's lawyer, Harold Koh, who told a Senate committee that that bombing Tripoli in an unconstitutional war in Libya would not be war and would not be hostilities and therefore would not be covered by the War Powers Act because it can't be war or hostilities if Americans aren't on the ground. Never mind that there were some Americans on the ground, but this is the argument. It's not really war. It's not really death. It's not really hostile if you're merely killing merely non-Americans, that 95% of humanity that we so casually dismiss. And with drones, of course, the argument is that, you know, setting aside eventual blowback, setting aside the stress suffered by the drone pilots, which is higher than for actual pilots, you're not risking American lives, and therefore, you know, I've actually had someone tell me drones are better than armies because no one gets killed with drones, meaning no Americans. And there are those waking up to this. The international community is awake to the criminality of this drone use. But President Obama gave an interview last week to CNN where he essentially said, I decide with my subordinates, and I kill who I want to kill, and I consider that due process. I've respected the constitutional rights of these Americans, adults or children, who I choose to kill with a drone or with a bullet, and their constitutional right to due process has been respected because I'm careful about it. Well, that's not due process. That's not checks and balances. There's no courts involved, no legislature, no public, no international body, just the president and his subordinates. And the outrage would be incredible were Obama a Republican. There are a handful pushing back. There were two courageous men convicted of trespassing yesterday and will be sentenced to prison for protesting drones in Missouri at one of the bases from which they are piloted. But for the most part, Obama supporters don't know, literally do not know, despite a front page story in the New York Times. And so it's not enough to protest. We have to inform people that this kill list program exists, and then protest it, which puts us a couple steps behind as activists.
As activists, there has been a dark, cold season for those who support peace or oppose the imposition of improper war. And the idea that there is a Democratic Party president who is of African American heritage has created, I think, among the progressive and the anti-war movement and the liberal movement and in communities of ethnicity, a syndrome that I will refer to as the Obama paralysis. What's your thought on that?
Well, I think that his skin color and his heritage as an African American is a big part of it. I think a much bigger part of it is that he is the president and the nominee of the Democratic Party, and that we think we have two choices, and that as rational, practical people who understand we only have two choices, we must make that lesser evil choice, not just in that moment in the voting booth, but year in, year out, every day of our lives. We must apologize for the lesser evil team, avoid knowing about its crimes, hide its crimes, exclusively criticize and protest the more evil team, and so forth, which is a bizarre and completely different approach, requiring a wholly different argument from that of making that rational choice of a lesser evil candidate in the voting booth. I mean, you ought to walk out of that voting booth, whether you voted for the lesser evil or actually a good candidate, being a good citizen, being willing to oppose what your government is doing. I've actually tried offering people who want me to campaign for Obama's reelection because Romney would be worse, which is itself questionable. I've actually tried making an exchange. You agree to join me in protesting these wars and this militarism and this level of military spending, and then I'll join you in trying to elect Barack Obama. And I don't get any takers because they consider it part of their duty as Obama supporters not to protest our government's crimes, at least not until next year, depending on how the election goes. So this is a serious, serious handicap. I mean, there are forces moving in the other direction. The Occupy movement is relaunching for the second year on Monday. This is going to be very encouraging. And there's a huge protest happening in Korea right now, where the World Conservation Congress is meeting on an island where a U.S./Korean naval base is going to destroy the natural environment of a good portion of the island. And that circumstance has managed to bring big environmental groups, including the Sierra Club and dozens of groups from around the world, into opposing the construction of a military base. And it's these kinds of expansions of coalitions where I find more hope than in party conventions.
Our guest is David Swanson, the author of War is a Lie. You've also done work under the rubric of War is a Crime. And you're very active with RootsAction.org. And David, there's another matter here, in addition to the illicit warfare and death that is being visited around the world because of what purports to be a reaction to 9/11, even though there are financial boons for the security and military manufacturing industries, and their influence on political campaigns can never be as deeply addressed as their existence. But there's another issue I'd like to put on the table for us today, and no discussion of so-called 9/11 would be complete without a reference to Osama bin Laden. And with a great deal of ferocity and rhetorical braggadocio, President Obama and his supporters are doing the rhetorical equivalent of carrying his head around at the end of a pike. And yet, at the event of September 11th, 2001, commercial commentators were in a frenzy saying, "This is a declaration of war." And some legal analysts say, no, it was a crime. War is a compact between nations that is declared and then conducted. And yet a crime that might actually be described as terrorism, but a crime, not a declaration of war, was used to have the college law professor Barack Obama egregiously violate the due process clause of the Constitution, not only with Osama bin Laden, who some would argue ought to have been arrested and stand trial for his responsibility of that terrible day and that terrible act, as opposed to feeding red meat to the electorate and saying, "We got him, we killed him." Is it insane to try and redress the legal protocols that obtain even in internationally committed crimes, much less the assassination of American citizens?
Well, I think it degrades our entire culture and politics to be celebrating the murder of anyone, even had that person been convicted in a court of mass murder. For us to celebrate killing as we use the death penalty, you know, the last industrialized Western country to use the death penalty, as we sell weapons, you know, we tripled our sales of weapons to foreign dictators last year. We are the weapons supplier of the world. As we witness endless sprees of violence domestically, and we wonder where they came from. As we glorify violence in our entertainment, as we create fake war shows on television, which In fact, RootsAction.org played a role in ending this NBC show that's now off the air. I think it's an incredible perversion of the idea of justice. Violence is not justice, and it's sickening to watch people cheer at these Democratic Party rallies, not just for the killing of bin Laden, but for the continuation of the war in Afghanistan, which people like Tim Kaine and John Kerry are constantly pushing and promoting and cheering for these humanitarian wars that will make people better off. This guy, whether he's telling the truth or not, who came out with a book on his participation in killing bin Laden, says that it wasn't to murder him, and yet it was a kill or capture, not a capture or kill assignment. And when he was lying, bleeding from the head, helpless on the ground, they put a lot more bullets into him. I would call that murder. And this, of course, bin Laden being someone who worked for the U.S. government as our ally in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union for years and was celebrated as such. Decades from now, when everybody's cheering over the body of some terrorist from Syria, I would like to be on record as having opposed the support we are now giving to him. This is the kind of lesson we aren't learning.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow, and that is David Swanson. He is the author of War is a Lie. He is a key leader in the operation called RootsAction.org, a global protest movement. And his work can be seen on davidswanson.org. And I commend our listeners' attention to your most recent piece called The Method to the Post-9/11 Madness, which has deep historical roots going back to Eisenhower and into the future. And I thank you for joining us today, David Swanson. You've been an enlightenment.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we continue today's reminiscence of the events and consequences of the 11th of September 2001, in which we will hear an acoustic review of the breaking events of that day that combined the resources of Free Speech Radio News, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, also your reporter by way of the Knight Report. And we begin that with a poem dedicated to the memory and meaning of 9/11, as recited and performed by the late performance artist Steve Ben Israel.
This poem is called Do You Remember? I Remember. Do you remember that morning when the planes crashed into the World Trade Center and turned us all into dust? Do you remember the Xerox copies of the photos of the lost and cell phone numbers written in magic markers that were plastered all over the walls of the city with their deadly cry of hope? Do you remember the beautiful poetry that turned up a few days later alongside the photos of the lost? I remember standing on Canal Street that morning, watching the towers coming down, the crowd around me breaking into tears, while others too shocked in disbelief. I remember a black man who got out alive and covered from head to toe in white dust, asked me if I could get him a beer. I remember going to a hardware store to buy myself a mask, but they were sold out, so I bought an American flag handkerchief on the corner and wrapped it around my face like the Lone Ranger. People walking by said, "Excuse me, may I take your picture?" Do you remember the wilted flowers stuck on all the chain-link fences around the city? Do you remember nobody blew their horn for 3 months in New York City? Do you remember the anthrax scare? I remember calling the great Arnie Sacca and a big fan of WBAI and said, "Arnie." He said, "Who's this?" I said, "Steve." He said, "Steve." I said, "Arnie." And at the same time, we said the Reichstag fire. Do you remember freedom fries? Do you remember the cops from Atlanta and Miami parked in the village and everyone starting conversations and thanking them for coming up to help with shock talk? Do you remember the attackers were from Saudi Arabia and met in Afghanistan and then the USA destroyed the country? Do you remember all the flags and flag buttons on the jackets to show you were truly American and folks wearing baseball hats that said NYPD, FDNY, and USA? I remember all that Uncle Sam's old glory. Do you remember the checkpoints on Canal Street and Houston Street and 14th Street and 23rd Street and so on? I had to show my ID 3 times when walking home. Do you remember the Middle Eastern profiling and the Indian man in Staten Island who was killed wearing a turban for revenge as the heat was taken off black people for a minute? Do you remember the cries for revenge and the bodies keep piling up and it's still not enough? I remember our son Baba stranded in Staten Island calling me from a phone booth telling me about all the papers that blew in from Manhattan. Do you remember Orange Alert and what's in your bag? Do you remember Union Square and all the great vibes and music and the 3 black boys singing Beatle tunes and their father was on washtub bass drowning out the politicos chanting their chickens have come home to roost? I remember one of my neighbors was part of the cleanup crew and gave me a burnt quarter. Do you remember walking by the firehouses with the mountains of flowers all around and going over to firefighters and shaking their hands and trying to find the right words? I remember going to Ladder Company 39 because my friend Keith Glasso had worked there and I gave out copies of my Warm It Up poem. They made me coffee, the firefighters did, and we talked what a beautiful man Keith was. I met his parents a week later. There were tears underneath my shades, and they were so stoic. I remember my great friend Tony Fish Nunziata rang my bell, and I couldn't recognize his voice, but I buzzed him in anyhow, and he walking up the stairs wearing a fireman's suit and his face full of gray dust. I said, can I help you? He said, it's me, Tony. I said, what are you doing in that outfit? He said, I've been putting out fires down at Ground Zero as a volunteer. He started to wash up. I could see his face now. He said, as soon as he heard about the first plane crashing into the tower, I ran over to our local firehouse and told them I'm a Vietnam veteran, a former lifeguard, and that I'm in pretty good shape. And they said, suit this guy up. I held those heavy giant fire hoses for nearly 4 hours. Tony Fish Nunziata died last year. And if I wonder if he got that lymphoma at Ground Zero, or maybe he got it in Vietnam. I miss him so. I remember coming out of the Spring Street subway, and there were 6 soldiers with AK-47s and machine guns. I said, how you guys doing, and where you from? I told the guy from Boston that one day the Red Sox would win the World Series. Do you remember the great fear that came upon us from the terrorists and from the White House? That tried to stop all our visions of a better world and the paranoia that still hangs over us. Do you remember there was a big difference talking to folks before and after we invaded those countries? I remember I had to gather all my love and keep it working for me, and it's still so hard. Do you remember and you wondered if it would ever get any better than this, and you still do? I remember changing my answering machine message to, hi, you've reached Steve, Pamela, and Baba. We're out making the world a better place to live in. At the beep, leave a message.
This is from Uneasy Listening, Pacifica Radio's Civil War by Matthew Lazar. The chapter is God Bless Pacifica. It was September 10th, 2001. The next morning, WBAI's Robert Knight lay on his bed and stared at the ceiling of his apartment. Knight lived on the 32nd floor of a huge apartment complex in Lower Manhattan, right off the East River. From his spacious living room window, he could see the Bronx, Queens, and the United Nations building nearby. From his bedroom, he could survey the entire Manhattan skyscraper line from Battery Park to the Empire State Building. Far beyond, in fact, thanks to a small collection of telescopes. As Knight lay there, the radio chattered in the background. He was in a bad mood, having gotten little sleep that night. Knight rose, checked on the news on his computer, and tuned to the radio to WBAI, from which he had recently been fired by Utrice Lead. Listening to the station put him in a worse mood. Bleary-eyed, he went back to bed. Then he noticed the plane. Quote, "I could see the wings and all different parts of it," end quote, Knight recalled. "It flew at a disturbingly low altitude right over a densely populated area of Manhattan. You never see planes there," he later explained, "because the Federal Aviation Administration has rules that traffic has to fly over the Hudson River and sort of avoid the center of Manhattan." Still half asleep, Knight puzzled over what he had observed. "It's like when Niagara Falls freezes," he said. "You know that there's an anomaly." Then the radio announced that the World Trade Center had been hit. He rushed to the window, and there, to his horror, stood the Northern Tower in flames. Knight immediately turned on his satellite cable TV in his computer and grabbed a long telescope. He pointed it at the building. "You could see the black smoke coming out of the impact zone of the plane," Knight remembered. But having covered many fires as a reporter, this blaze struck him as different. "I could see it burning in places where it should not be burning. I could see it burning 10 and 15 stories above and below. Little pockets of flame." Suddenly, the second tower exploded. Knight jumped back and desperately scoured the radio dial for news. Two planes had hit the complex en route from Boston and headed to California. One commercial station reporter explained, "There must be some kind of navigational error that's drawing the planes to this place," the announcer speculated. Knight shuddered. No, he felt sure this was no error. "I knew that this was a maximal bomb. Two giant bullets filled with high-density kerosene jet fuel." The telephone rang. KPFA's Dennis Bernstein and Democracy Now! Wanted Knight to go live with a report, and so Knight narrated the September 11th attacks from the vantage point of his apartment. Armed with his telescopes, he described the collapse of the buildings, smoke cascading into the sky, thousands of New Yorkers fleeing Manhattan on foot via bridges, soot and debris floating up the East River, the FDR Drive cleared for ambulances. And to his dismay, the paucity of survivors, as it became all too clear that most casualties caused by this terrorist act would be fatal. And that's a reading from Uneasy Listening, Pacifica Radio's Civil War, by Matthew Lazar.
We are broadcasting not far from the World Trade Center towers. Both have gone down in the last hours in a massive attack that seems to extend from New York to Washington, D.C., where all federal buildings have been evacuated. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile. The latest news we have is that there have been widespread attacks that include at least three commercial jet crashes. We now believe perhaps four. Three commercial jet crashes into significant buildings. In the first attack, a plane hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center in Manhattan shortly before 9 o'clock, followed by another plane into the second tower about 20 minutes later. Both towers later collapsed. About an hour later, a plane crashed into the Pentagon, part of which later collapsed. American Airlines told CNN that it lost two planes in tragic accidents. Flight 11 from Boston with 81 passengers and 11 crew aboard, and Flight 77 from Washington Dulles Airport with 58 passengers and 6 crew aboard. Both planes were en route to Los Angeles. United Airlines Flight 93 airliner headed from Newark, New Jersey to San Francisco crashed near Somerset, Pennsylvania. Police said initial reports indicated no survivors. It was not known if this was connected to the attacks. United also said it was deeply concerned about Flight 175 from Boston to Los Angeles. The Pentagon, the White House, the State Department, the Justice Department, the Capitol, the CIA, and all other government buildings in Washington have been evacuated. President Bush canceled an appearance in Florida to return to Washington, calling the crashes, quote, apparent terrorist attacks and, quote, a national tragedy. In the first ever national ground stop of aircraft, all flights nationwide have been stopped at their departure airports. All international flights were diverted to Canada. In New York, more than 10,000 rescue personnel have rushed to the scene. The entire downtown area of Manhattan, the mayor has recommended people evacuate, though we are in that area, and certainly so are thousands of other people. Israel has evacuated all its missions around the world. In Chicago, the Sears Tower was evacuated. The United Nations in New York has been evacuated. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta was evacuated. CDC was preparing bioterrorism teams in case they become necessary. The New York Port Authority says it has closed all bridges and tunnels into the city. Today is primary day in New York. These elections have been canceled. You're listening to Democracy Now! As we go first to Robert Knight, who is on the line with us. He is right by the United Nations. Robert, can you talk about what you saw this morning?
Yes, indeed. I am reporting from an elevated location on the East River within line of sight to the United Nations, as well as the World Trade Center and the Empire State Building. This morning at approximately 15 minutes before 9 o'clock, I was disturbed looking out of my window with the sound and the quick passage of what appeared to be a commercial plane. It was unusual because the general aviation rule in New York is that north and southbound traffic must travel over the Hudson River. This plane was too close to the center of Manhattan. As it traveled south, it caught my attention, and minutes later, a plane would indeed crash into the North Tower of the World Trade Center. I believe that is the plane that I saw. What is remarkable about what we now know to have been two crashes into the World Trade Center is the anomalous behavior in Manhattan now. The Empire State Building has been evacuated. The United Nations Secretariat and General Assembly buildings have been evacuated. As I look down at this very moment on the East River as the tide rises, there is an unusual pattern of fine-grained debris, which I believe has washed up from lower Manhattan by this amount of time since the initial crashes. There have been closures of tunnels and bridges coming into New York, but as I look through the telescope, I can see torrents of pedestrian traffic moving eastbound across the 59th Street Bridge to move out of Manhattan. The bridge is closed to automobile traffic. Right now, as I look down on the FDR Highway, that is an expressway that runs on the east side of Manhattan, north and southbound, it has been closed to traffic for some hours, with the exception of police, fire, ambulance, and other emergency vehicles. It has been almost like a ghost highway, except for the ferrying and shuttling of ambulances with what few people they can bring back from what has to be a tremendously high toll of the explosions at the World Trade Center. As I look north at the United Nations at this very moment, it is being circled and ringed by a number of police boats, presumably under the assumption that the United Nations might well have also been a target. One other significant factor, Amy, I think that should be noted tactically or logistically. If indeed there is a central coordination of the crashing of these commercial airliners, I think it's significant that those that are missing are those that were outbound from the East Coast for destinations on the West Coast. That means that these planes would have had the maximum amount of jet fuel in them, and if that was a factor, it would have been a logical one, so that when, for instance, the second plane crashed into the Southern Tower, there was a tremendous fireball. So it remains to be investigated, although it seems plausible that choosing a long-distance flight would provide more fuel for more deadly explosive effects.
I wanted to bring Reem Khatkhuda into this discussion. We're talking about two 110-story towers of the World Trade Center. 50,000 people work there. 150,000 people are there every day. The number of casualties at this point are untold, but they must be extremely high and devastating. Reem, what did you see and hear?
I was stuck on the roof with a clear view of both towers, and there were flames coming out of the towers, 20 feet high flames, and lots of smoke, mostly dark, and then the smoke started to get lighter, and then suddenly the second tower, the more south of this, kind of like exploded and then collapsed in itself with debris falling everywhere. It was definitely a full building collapse from where we were looking at. That's how it looked, and it was crumbling. And the second tower was oscillating at that point, probably from the wind of the first one, and we could see it clearly. It was a very big angle, visible angle. It was swinging, and that's the tower with the antenna. I also saw the huge amount of smoke and steam floating and almost covering the downtown area. And here with us on the phone, I have Kasia, my neighbor, who actually saw the second tower collapse.
We kind of hoped that the second tower would not collapse because the fire was in the upper part of it. But it happened the same thing as with the first tower. It just suddenly collapsed straight down, and the only good thing was that it went straight down and not, you know, on the other buildings that are there. So we were all shocked.
People were crying on the roofs. People were hugging each other. People were trembling head to toes. It was a horrifying sight, and even for me, who's seen a lot of buildings collapse in Lebanon by vacuum bombs and others, it was just horrific to see it. We looked around town, we looked at Midtown that was very visible from where we're at, and people were saying, like, will there be another thing? Will there be another thing? Slowly, the smoke that stood in place of the two towers moved a little bit lower within the lower area. And there were a lot of ambulances, a lot of fire trucks going. And when I went down to the street, I saw a lot of people who went to school to get their children. People talked about people burned head to toes. And the emergency rooms and the different hospitals need blood. That's what the word was on the streets. People were telling each other, have you given blood? Are you going to go give blood? Because people need blood in the hospitals.
Amy?
Robert Knight.
In reference to Mayor Giuliani, for our national audience, not everyone might recall that sometime after the ground-level bombing of one of the World Trade Center buildings, that Mayor Giuliani subsequently established a so-called crisis and terrorism center, an emergency so-called bunker, which was oddly enough located on the 22nd floor of the World Trade Center. Of course, we now know that he was not in that center, fortunately, this morning, and was operating out of a firehouse in Greenwich Village. The mayor did indicate that he has been in touch with the governor, George Pataki, of New York State, and that National Guard has been alerted and is en route to help relieve and assist the some 10,000 or more emergency service personnel whose work will be endless over the coming days. So we expect the arrival of state level authorities to assist in the emergency search and rescue operations for the untold number of casualties that will have eventually been discovered.
Robert Knight reporting to us from the United Nations area. And just for people who are outside of New York to get a picture of the island, he is about halfway up on the east side. He is on the East River. The United Nations up around 44th Street and First Avenue, World Trade Center at the tip of Manhattan. We are in the middle, just above the tip of Manhattan, broadcasting from Chinatown from Engine Company 31, where Downtown Community Television and Manhattan Neighborhood Network have graciously given us their studios in this monumental tragedy that is taking place, unfolding as we speak. This is a national emergency for the first time ever. All flights have been canceled in the United States with the what appears to be an attack on the World Trade Center towers. Both have collapsed. The images this morning, and we're going to bring Robert back up as he was watching, as well as Reem Khairhuda, the images on television of people hanging on to the World Trade Center towers, those top floors, jumping before those towers collapsed. But after the first plane went into one of the towers, it was about 8:45. Then 20 minutes later, the second, what appears to be attack on the towers, and then by 10:30, both towers had collapsed. Robert.
Yes, as I watch the ongoing activity on the eastern side of Manhattan, of course, the smoky tableau of the empty space in the horizon where the World Trade Towers used to be continues apace. There is debris that I believe came from that area, even now visible on the surface of the East River. What I've been monitoring traffic and emergency-wise has been a shutting down to transportation of this artery, as well as, of course, bridges and tunnels coming into New York City. There is pedestrian traffic walking across bridges, the Brooklyn Bridge, walking across the 59th Street Bridge. Many people on foot evacuating Manhattan at this point in time. I noticed that many city buses have been drafted into service and are, I don't know, carrying police or health workers or others downtown every now and then. There is a constant stream of ambulances coming into the Bellevue Medical Facility area. There are a number of hospitals in what could be called, at least in part, a medical district on the middle eastern side of the island of Manhattan. But one cannot help but think that this trickle adequately served the thousands of people who might have been at risk with the unprecedented level of destruction in the southern tip of Manhattan.
This morning, two hijacked planes crashed into the upper floors of both World Trade Center's towers, blasting fiery gaping holes in the 110-story building, ultimately bringing both towers down, bringing down a third building. Another hijacked plane smashed into the Pentagon, and a fourth plane went down in Pennsylvania. First, we go to Robert Knight in New York City.
Good evening, Dennis. At this very moment, the sun is setting over New York City, but the sunset is all the wrong colors. A short time ago, just before it dipped below the horizon, the sky was a translucent yellow color because of the particulate matter that is the residue of what was once the World Trade Center towers, built in 1966, completed in 1972, and now no longer extant. The sun descended as the smoke rose, dominating the southern horizon of Manhattan, and it created eerie purple and pink overtones for the sunset, such as I have not seen since the eruption of Mount St. Helens, when our sunsets became oddly colored. There are other oddities about the conditions of New York City right now, the lack of traffic, the lack of familiar lights in the evening sky. From the place where I'm reporting right now, which is an elevated location, I am used to seeing the pattern of planes descending into LaGuardia Airport, helicopters, traffic choppers, and so on. None of that is taking place, of course, because of the Federal Aviation Authority's shutdown of traffic across the country, at least until noon tomorrow. In fact, the only things I believe that are flying in New York are seagulls and satellites. There is no traffic in the air, very little traffic on the street. I'm looking down at the FDR Highway, one of the main expressways on the eastern side of Manhattan, and that throughway has been used for emergency traffic throughout the day, but there have been far too few ambulances and emergency vehicles to account for the numbers of people that must have been caught in the explosion or the crashes and detonations that resulted in the leveling of the World Trade Center towers. As it happens, earlier this morning at approximately 8:45 Eastern Daylight Time, I was alarmed by seeing a commercial airliner fly by my window. It was traveling too low and too loud and too close. Traditionally, when a plane is approaching one of the New York area airports, they are instructed to fly over the Hudson River, not over the center of Manhattan, as this one did, southbound, going right down the spine of the city. And just minutes later, indeed, such a plane would crash into the northernmost of the two World Trade Center towers. I watched the horrible eruption of smoke and fire, and through a telescope, I noticed that beyond the obvious point of impact and billows of smoke, there were pockets of orange flame that were too many floors away from the point of impact. I'm speaking tens of stories away, which can lead me to conclude only that the heavily fueled plane that had been prepared for a flight across the continent and therefore full of jet fuel must have created a tremendous backdraft inside the building. And it would be only minutes later that a second plane would create an unbelievably large fireball of explosions that within less than an hour would result in the collapse of both of those buildings. During that time, I monitored the radio traffic of the New York City Police Emergency Services. Among the things I noted were a request by the local utility Consolidated Edison for an escort to shut off gas mains to prevent secondary explosions. There were immediate orders for the evacuation of the United Nations and the Empire State Building, and numerous reports of suspicious vehicles and bomb scares and school closings. The mayor's so-called terrorism bunker emergency command center, which was located in one of the World Trade buildings, building number 7, was the third one to collapse. A 40-story office building collapsed just 2 hours ago, and there's concern about yet another building from structural damage and continuing fires. The National Guard is en route to New York, at least 2,000 members of that, to spell the emergency personnel who have been working throughout the day, of course. Taxi cabs have been commandeered to help bring medical personnel to the places where they are needed. The latest report I have, Dennis, is that 2,000 people are being treated in area hospitals. And, of course, at this stage, the number of fatalities reported is completely unreliable as a gauge to the total toll of today's event.
You're listening to Flashpoints on KPFA. We're speaking with Robert Knight, who, as you can tell, is in New York City, has been watching this scene unfold throughout the day.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. Today's program was engineered by Michael G. Haskins and produced with Thiago Barroso. If you have tips, comments, leaks, questions, or suggestions for 5 o'clock Shadow, drop us an email at theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 o'clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.